Coffee with a Coastie is brought to you by On the Coast Publications, the publishing house for On the Coast families and On the Coast over 55 community magazines on the central coast of New South Wales.
Welcome to Coffee with a Coastie. I'm excited to have Maz Compton join me today to discuss life, sobriety, her podcast Last Drinks, and her latest book of the same name, Last Drinks. Maz's journey has been a captivating one, spanning from MTV host to becoming a gym owner and a prominent breakfast radio host. So it is an honour and a pleasure that I get to chat with Maz today.
Thanks, welcome, Luke. Maz. How are you going?
I'm good, Maz. I'm good. Thank you for inviting me into the studio to be able to chat with you today.
It's fine. This is my second home. So
I've no doubt.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in here and I feel very comfortable. So this is great.
That's good. So you feel comfortable. I'm just a little bit uncomfortable. That's good. We're good.
That's just the way it should be. No?
That's right. So before we jump into talking about your book and sobriety, can we get to know a little about Maz? As I understand it, you were born in England and came to Australia with your family when you were 8, as your dad was going to join a ministry, if I got it correctly, though didn't, and you ended up growing up on the northern beaches. So I wondered what life was like as Maz growing up.
That, you've nailed it. That's exactly what happened. Born in the UK when I was 8, my dad came to study in Sydney at a Bible college and relocated the family for 12 months. And then I think that my parents just fell in love with the sunshine, so we stayed. So my grandparents sold a house in the UK and we stayed here. And I think the only reason that we landed on the northern beaches was my dad's brother was living there at the time, and that's close to where the Bible college was, so it kind of made a bit of sense. And then, yeah, a series of unfortunate events meant that my dad didn't end up going into ministry, but we stayed here, and I had a pretty normal, regular childhood, and I think the undertone of religion was a huge part of my upbringing because my dad wanted to run a church.
Yeah. And what were you like as a child? Like, so, and I mainly ask this because obviously we're going to talk about sobriety. And I know, like, for anybody that doesn't know, I'm sober 4.5 years almost now.
Yeah.
And so I hear the story a lot growing up, bit insecure as a child, you know, that sort of thing, shy.
Oh, God, no.
That's why I was just sort of curious as to what you were like as a child. Like,
yeah,
story is that I was slightly insecure, or was insecure and shy and that sort of thing. I've got that story.
So, I was very, very confident as a child. I hung in high school, I hung out with the nerdier group. Like, I was the president of the environment club, but I was always in the leadership role. Like, I directed the end of school play, and I always had, I felt like I was that kid that ended up being friends with everyone at graduation. And yeah, I think I was really comfortable leading. I was always in like a prefect and roles like that. I acted a lot in high school. I was in a TV show. So I was very confident as a youngster, really confident and really good at public speaking as well. That was one of my strong suits. I was like the Lions Youth of the Year at one point. I went on a school exchange program and there were only 4 kids from our whole school that got to do that. So I was really confident, I think. And quite extrovert, probably a little obnoxious thinking about it now, but that was me.
And do you think any of that come about, like, to try to get attention, like, to try to, like, I'm just curious.
I don't think I was an attention seeker.
Well, not attention, you liked to please people, or you like to entertain, like, you know, through that entertaining is pleasing people and is...
Yeah, that's really interesting. I haven't psychoanalyzed my childhood that much
we can do it now.
I just haven't looked at it through that filter. I think I had like a pretty stable upbringing. I was at school just really comfortable in front of a crowd. But I don't know that it was because I was people pleasing. I don't know when you're that young if you, I don't know, try to do things to impress people for popularity. But I don't know that that was the driver for me. Like that, I just was who I was. Yeah, do you know what I mean? And I felt like I had a really good self-esteem and a really, I had like a really good friendship group, had really solid friends. I had a pretty stable home life. And I think I had a really healthy self-image when I was a teenager. I think that would be a good way to describe sort of where I was at in those years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's interesting because that leads me on to my next question, where if we jump to your first drink at 15 at an after party, where I can't remember where I read this, but it was your comment was rum straight from the bottle, guzzled down to fit in. Is how I heard you explain it in this article I read.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that first drink and what it did for you and how that was about fitting in?
Oh, God, yeah. So at 15 in high school, it was inevitable. It wasn't a question of like, ooh, am I going to drink alcohol? It was just a matter of when. Like, when am I choosing my moment? And so I chose my moment and it was the end of school play after party or maybe the middle of – I think it was the middle of the year. And we were in the play together and there was an after party at Gemma's house. And on the way to the party, a friend of a friend of a friend of ours who had a friend who was 18, got them to get some rum. And then we just like drank it out of the bottle on the way to the party. And me, never having consumed alcohol before, was told by my parents don't drink, was told by Mrs. Barnes don't drink, was told by everyone who was an adult don't drink. We all drank because it's what we were all going to do that night. But because I was an incredibly small human being when I was 15 years old, like I'm 5'1" now, so I was very, very tiny. I was the smallest person in my grade. I had no idea what alcohol straight from a bottle would do to me. And so I didn't quite make it to the party. I'd passed out at the front lawn of the house and then a friend of mine rang her mum to come and collect us from the party and to try and help me get sober before the mum called my parents because we were 15 and my parents had to come and collect me from my friend's house. And it's so humiliating. It was the most embarrassing situation ever. And you would think after such an adverse experience with alcohol that one would never drink again, but I'm pretty sure it was 2 weeks later that somebody was like, you know, if you cut the rum with Coca-Cola, like it doesn't smash your inside so bad and maybe you won't vomit yourself silly. And I was like, okay, well, I'll try that. And then I think that that's just what everyone in high school did. It was every weekend, every other weekend, or so it felt like it, drinking and hanging around and chatting and just being teenagers. So I didn't have a really pleasant introduction to alcohol, but somehow it didn't deter me from just doing what everyone was doing, which I think is quite normal.
And how did the comment of fit in? So the fit in's not so much fit in because you felt uncomfortable within yourself, but fit in because everybody else was drinking. Oh, just because
it wasn't even, it was like, okay, cool. Like, okay, yeah, we'll drink rum because everyone else is doing it. So why would you not do that?
Yeah.
You know? And I think also me being so naive, like I actually knew what alcohol did, like really and truly. And so I didn't, I just had no idea how toxic and plutonic it was. And so, you know, with zero sense, I just went along with what everyone else was doing and it just did not work out well for me that night.
And how did your parents deal with it?
They were pretty mad. So they came to my friend's house and picked me up. And I don't really remember a lot, like the details are hazy, but I just remember that their whole thing at the time was like, you've embarrassed us as a family.
Oh, there's a bit of that.
And this is so shameful. And like, what were you thinking? You know, like just the typical stuff. And I was like, well, I wasn't thinking, I was just doing what my friends did and it just didn't go well for me. And, you know, I probably didn't, you know, I was 15, so I don't think you handle anything well when you're 15, especially when you're being held to account for it. So, yeah, they were pretty mad, which is fine. Like it wasn't, you know, like we all got over it in the end and I think we went out for brunch the next day. But there was definitely like some big conversations that we had at home about my behavior and being grounded and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's part of it, isn't it? In your latest book, Last Drinks, you mentioned that in your MTV hosting days, you felt like you didn't fit in. So we're still around this not fitting in sort of thing, I suppose, with the glamorous crowds, and that even though things were going great, you were waking up each day with compounded feelings of anxiety, feeling overmanaged, undervalued, and insecure. You even mentioned quite a few times about having imposter syndrome. Knowing that being an MTV host was your dream job that you manifested as a 15-year-old, can you talk about this time in a way that now looking back would help someone else battling those same thoughts?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to just note is I think everyone has imposter syndrome. I think most people at some point in their life feel inadequate for what is on their plate. But
I'll jump in just quickly. I feel that way right now.
Okay. And so what we need to learn to do is to learn tools that will help us cope with those moments. So it's not about avoiding situations where you feel overwhelmed or where you feel out of your league or where you don't feel like you necessarily deserve to be there. It's about learning how to sit in that uncomfortability and being okay with it. And I did not have any of those coping tools. So to backtrack, when I was 15, around that whole incident, I also wrote in my journal that I wanted to be on MTV. Again, at the time, I was this, you know, super confident kid. I loved being in front of a crowd. I loved pop music, and it made sense that I would host MTV one day. 9 years later, it's not a straight story, but I got there eventually and I was doing my dream job. And so I've gone from the girl in high school who was a bit of a late bloomer and a bit of a nerd to the girl who's fronting a pop culture station that everyone was obsessed with. And I think that leap left me with big, big doubt over my ability, because I didn't really, even though I really wanted it, I think secretly I really thought it would never happen, because I didn't think that dreams came true. I thought that dreams are always broken. And there's a whole backstory on why I thought that, but we don't need to go there today. So when I did land that job, it was awesome and I was so excited, but I was overwhelmed with this feeling of like, I don't feel equipped to do this. And so when are they going to figure that the jig is up? When are they going to work out that I'm just this like normal kid from the Northern Beaches who's just like kicking along and just had a dream that was maybe a little bit too big for her boots kind of thing? So I think that that's how that whole cycle of anxiety and all of that sort of started to manifest in my life. And then added to that was, I'm a very, I love being in control. I wouldn't say that I'm a control freak, but I probably have like a slight strain of OCD. And so I'm a planner. I'm a routine person. Like I function best when things are in my control and as much as I can be like hands-on with stuff. And when I became a VJ at MTV, I relinquished all control of my life over to a job where I was told when to show up, how to show up, what to wear, how to do my hair, how long my hair needed to be, what color my nails needed to be, what dress I was wearing, what dress fitting I was going to. And my whole world became so micromanaged by a group of people who I didn't know, and that left me feeling really out of control. And so that feeling of feeling out of control was really, really difficult for me to grapple with. And so I think what I did is I lent to alcohol, because I had all of these insecurities started to come up. Like I said, I was a really confident kid, but when I got to MTV, somehow I almost lost my confidence because I started doubting my ability. And so then I was feeling anxious, and then that's like a bit of a negative feedback loop. And then I was not feeling like I had any control over my life, and so I needed to take back a bit of control. And what I could control every day was a glass of wine to reward myself for doing a good job and getting through it. And as much as it was so fun, I had the best time. I don't regret anything. I had the most incredible experience, but it just ruined me on a emotional level for, you know, like I think a number of reasons. And so the way that I think I just dealt with that, because again, I didn't have the tools or the equipment at the time to deal with big feelings, to deal with imposter syndrome and to deal with all the stuff that I was feeling. I just drank alcohol just to kind of get by. And alcohol in media at the time was such a currency. It was, you know, we used to joke at MTV, the pay was terrible, but the booze was free. So you just drink your salary, you know, and there were so many amazing experiences that it felt bad to not enjoy it. So I forced myself to enjoy it, even though sometimes I didn't really want to be there. I had to.
And what's your advice now for someone that would be in that situation?
I think first of all, manifest a dream that you really do want and know that it might not feel how you think it's going to feel if you get it. And secondly, learn the tools. Like I do a bit of work on you, whether it's through therapy or counseling or trauma therapy, I don't know. Do some work on you so you really truly know how you are and that you can learn some strategies on sitting with big feelings in uncomfortable moments and get good at that, because that I think will help.
How long were you doing the MTV gig for?
5 years.
And just, I know there's a long story to it, but you said 9 years between 15 and MTV, so manifesting that dream.
Mm.
How did you end up at MTV near the end there?
So they were advertising for a VJ in a magazine, and I saw the ad and I sent in a tape. And then it took about a year from that moment to me actually getting the job, and through a series, like a number of auditions and callbacks, and it was quite a painstaking experience, to be honest. But I eventually got offered a job to launch TRL in Australia, which is actually what I had written down in my diary that I wanted to do.
TRL?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And what were you doing just before, like just before MTV?
I was an assistant producer on a breakfast show.
You were Nova.
I was at Nova.
Yeah. Cool. So you've said that your life was a disaster zone before quitting alcohol. What does a disaster zone look like? And probably more importantly, what does it feel like?
Yeah, so on paper, my life was pretty awesome. So in 2014, I was doing the National Drive show. I had a pretty ironclad contract with Southern Cross or Stereo. I had a ton of money. I was getting flown all over the place to interview rock stars and pop stars. And I feel like, if you were to look at 2014 Maz, you'd go, wow, she's killing the game. But when I say it was a disaster zone, I mean internally I was unable to reconcile the success. So I felt like a big failure. I felt like, again, it was a similar undertone to the MTV stuff. I was like, oh, when are they going to realize that I don't actually think I'm great at radio? I would downplay my successes. And so, again, to deal with those feelings, I was drinking. So I was drinking a bottle of wine most days of the week just to, like, whether I was bored or busy or tired or had to go out or whatever it was. And so it wasn't that alcohol was ruining my life. It wasn't that alcohol was preventing me from doing my job. Alcohol was not getting in the way, but alcohol was there constantly. And it wasn't until I kind of looked at my calendar and I actually had a birthday party coming up. And I thought to myself, gosh, I wish I could just, I don't even want to go to that party because I don't want to drink. And it didn't occur to me that I could go to a party and not drink. And that was the first penny drop sober curiosity moment I had, when I thought, why can't you go to the party and not drink? And then I sort of started asking myself some questions about my relationship with alcohol. So when I say it was a disaster zone, like internally, it was just, if I kept going down the road that I was heading on, it wasn't going to end well for me. So I think it's knowing that, like feeling uncomfortable about how much I was drinking and how often I was drinking, I'm so glad that I had the courage to pull up stumps and go, okay, let's do a little bit of self-talk and let's do a bit of an assessment here.
Yeah, and I think the highlights that the disaster zone isn't never necessarily the external house or whatever that is.
It wasn't the internal. Anybody looking at my life would not have thought it was a disaster zone, but that was my assessment of what was going on. And that is the most critical assessment of your life, is your assessment of it.
Mm, definitely. You've said that you dappled with sober curiosity for a year before taking the leap on New Year's Eve 2014. What does dabbling in sober curiosity look like, and how did you come to stopping drinking on New Year's Eve of 2014? As I believe you have said, you didn't plan on never drinking again originally.
Yeah, so sober curiosity is what I was just saying before about just questioning your relationship with alcohol. So if you feel uncomfortable about how much you're drinking, if you lie about how much you drink, if you drink by yourself, if you just think about alcohol a lot, like I remember at lunchtime at work being like, God, I can't wait till 6 p.m. so I can have a drink, you know, that those sort of invisible boundaries and red flags around alcohol are worth questioning of like, why do you feel that way? Why do you need to get to 6 o'clock to have a drink? Why can't you hang out for 6 o'clock because you're going to the gym? So it's really just asking yourself questions about your relationship with alcohol, and the answers that I was getting back, I wasn't cool with. You know, and sometimes the questions I didn't have an answer. I was like, I actually don't know. I was like, why do you, you know, you ask yourself things like, okay, you woke up this morning, you said you're not going to drink today, but it's 6 p.m. and you're about to head through to the bottle shop. So what's happened between then and then? And why could you just drive a different way right now? But I didn't know. I just was always led back to me with a glass of wine in my hand, trying to, I guess, forget about the day or decompress or relax or get off to sleep or whatever excuse I'd given myself. So that to me is the definition of sober curiosity, just asking yourself questions around your drinking behavior. And then what really happened is I kind of made it up, right? So I Googled, this is like November 2014, I Googled, am I an alcoholic? And it turns out I'm not. Like, so I read the definition of an alcoholic and I was not one. According to what I read online, I was like, that's not me.
Do you remember what you read?
It was around the AA manifesto kind of vibe. I didn't feel powerless under a disease. I was like, oh, I've quit drinking for like a month before and it's been no big deal. So I just was like, my options really are go to AA, which to me didn't feel like it resonated. I know people who have been in the program. I know about the 12 steps. But it didn't feel like my solution. So then I was like, well, you're just gonna have to make it up. And so what I landed on was, if you don't change anything, nothing changes. So I was like, well, I need to change something. What do I need to change? I need to change my relationship with alcohol. How do I do that? I should stop drinking for a month. Like, it was not that articulate in my brain. It took me a while to get to that point. And then because I'm a goal setter and I'm a planner and I'm really organized, I set a date and I said, this is the day, January 1, 2015, no alcohol for 31 days. And that was my plan. And then the undertone of the plan was, instead of stopping drinking this time to prove that you don't have a problem, let's stop drinking to see what sobriety looks and feels like. And so I did heaps of stuff in that month, I guess filling in the time, to be honest, because I thought I would die of boredom. But I just did loads of new things. And I, you know, set appointments for beach morning walks on the beach as opposed to drinks at night. So I busied myself in that month. And then after a month, I was feeling so good. So I was like, let's get to my birthday, which is March 2nd. And then my birthday came and went and I didn't drink. And I was like, let's get to the middle of the year. And then we got to the end of June and I was like, well, it's dry July. And then I got to July and I was like, oh, let's get to October. And then it was October. And then I'd done 12 months. And I had never said I'm not going to drink again in that whole year. I just said I'm not drinking today.
At what point did you say I'm never drinking again?
Probably 5 years in, maybe six. So only a couple of years ago I started saying it out loud because people want to know. They're like, oh my God, you've been sober for 8 years. Like, are you just never going to drink again? And I'm like, well, yeah, I'm never going to drink again. But I didn't need to verbalize that for me because I'm fine with how I'm doing my life sober, but other people need to know that I'm not drinking again. So I'm really comfortable saying it now, but I didn't say never for a really long time. because I didn't want to, knowing how I work as a person, I didn't want to set myself up for failure and then sabotage a situation that I was doing really well at. So for me, it was better not to do the never evers in the first few years. It was just much better to go, I'm just not drinking right now and it's really working for me. So in the short term future, I do not see myself having a drink.
And I think that's very important. That's a very important lesson there for anyone listening. Is not projecting out into the future where you're never ever. There's an AA thing. There's a day at a time. And I think you even mentioned in the book somewhere about it was only ever about today, or it's just one day. It was now.
My whole mantra every day, every single day for the last 8.5 years has been, whatever happens today, I'm just not going to drink. But I didn't feel like I had to equate that into a lifelong statement that I had to hold myself accountable to. I just, for me, it worked easier and better to just go, okay, even if today is like the worst day in the world, and I've had a few of the worst days in the world in the last couple of years, I'm just not going to drink alcohol because it's not going to change the situation. It's not going to solve anything. It's just going to create more problems. It's not going to help my brain function better. It's going to add to my cognitive decline. It's going to make me feel like crap. It's going to impair my sleep. It's the knock-on negatives of alcohol are so real to me that now my life is just not worth rolling the dice on a drink. But it took me a long, long, long time in sobriety to get to a place where that's how I can just so casually say it now.
Yeah, but it's just so important, that whole just not applying the pressure. I'm never drinking.
And also other people's expectations can be really crippling, because then you might say, I'm never drinking again, and they'll be like, yeah, I doubt it, you know, and then you just, that's just crap.
Yeah.
That's not helpful, but people don't understand how their words can be quite entrapping.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting, you mentioned somewhere in the book too, which I felt was quite important, and I know we've caught up, we've met, seen each other outside, and I've had a brief conversation with you about even at 4.5 years, like I still have that bit, like going up and going, oh, I'll have a lemon squash, thanks. And like I feel as a male, like there's this whole, oh no, give me a beer, thanks mate, you know, like that sort of thing. And I remember talking to you about that after the fact, where you said, I can't remember how many years into it you said you were before you just felt, no, I'm having a lemon squash. Like,
yeah, it takes a couple of years, you know, and also just, I've been drinking since I was 15 years old. I'm 43. So I've been sober for 8 years, but I was getting drunk for a lot longer than I've been sober. And so it takes a really, really long time to rewire your brain chemistry and to feel comfortable in a situation that you've only ever done one habit in, you know, like, if drinking is habituated for you, it's really, I don't want to like deter anyone from sobriety, but it's not easy. Like I'm not getting cred for being sober because it's a walk in the park. I think I'm getting cred for being sober and talking about it because it is difficult and it is challenging, and so many people are struggling with their relationship with alcohol. So it's not easy, but it's worth it. And I know that it's doable because I've done it.
And many people have, that have been in much worse situations. It's definitely possible. In 2014, you were crowned Cosmopolitan's Woman of the Year in radio. I can only assume that this was a time when you were going through a lot inside. Do you remember this moment and how you felt being that it was so close to when you stopped drinking?
Yeah, that was awesome. Like, I think, winning an award for being yourself is pretty awesome. and that's really what it is, because who I am on radio is who I am as a person. And then I won this award for being on the radio. So it was really nice to be acknowledged by my peers and people who I genuinely like respect and idolize a bit in the industry. And so, yeah, it was, we had this fancy lunch down at Woolloomooloo Wharf, and I got a trophy, and it was awesome. I was like, oh, that's so nice to be acknowledged. I don't think there was an undertone of sadness at all. Like I even though I was drinking, like I was still able to see things for what they were and appreciate how great my life was. It wasn't, you know, like I don't think I was depressed. I just think that I was just drinking heaps and I wanted to stop. Like it's that top level headline stuff. It's, you know what I'm saying? Like sometimes I think we can just overanalyze stuff and like, you know what? I won an award and it was awesome. And I celebrated my success and that was great. And that's kind of the story. Do you know what I mean? Like there was no come down and like, oh, woe is me and I don't deserve this. I was like, well, I do deserve this because I work really hard. I work harder than anyone I know. And I won this award on my own merit. And so go me. Congratulations me. And I, you know, that might sound a bit arrogant to some people, but I think considering everything I'd been through imposter syndrome wise and, you know, feeling out of my depth, I think that was probably one of the better moments of my career where I was like, oh, okay, cool. People do notice and they do like me. That's nice.
Yeah, and I think that's where I ask that from, like knowing that like near the end of your drinking, you potentially, like I don't know for sure, but potentially there is that still that imposter syndrome. There's still that feelings of anxiety. And then you go and get awarded this award and you're like, wow, what am I feeling all this for? Like I am actually like people, you know, there's that validation, external validation when you don't feel so great.
Yeah.
But yet you get this external validation that sort of can pick you up and go, actually, why am I feeling this stuff inside? And
well, that's the disconnect, right? Like, and I think that that's kind of the place that I got to where I was like, I'm really good at what I do. Why am I drinking all the time? Oh, I should just stop drinking for a bit. Okay, well, that's going to be really hard. Okay, I'm not going to think about that for 6 months. And then you circle back to it when you haven't stopped drinking magically one day, even though you said you did. And so I just think it's, you know, again, it's a self-awareness and it's just being, having the courage to just have a conversation with yourself about where you're really at is the first sort of, I think, foray into any sort of change behavior.
Yeah. So the first episode of your podcast, Last Drinks, was on the 28th of June, 2022, and you're now... Potentially it's more than this now, but last I checked, it was 67 episodes in at last count. When you first started the podcast, did you have any idea just how many people would be prepared to share their story?
Not real. Again, I didn't really think about it as a long-term thing. I kind of had a bubbling inkling for a while that I wanted to do a podcast because everyone does podcasts.
As we are here.
Exactly. Yeah, I just wanted to do one, so I just decided to do that myself, and then I just started doing it. So I did it for me. I did it because I love having conversations about sobriety. I love hearing other people's journeys, and I love the format of podcasts because in radio you kind of have to, you know, after 4 minutes wrap it up and throw to a Pink song. So for me to just have long form conversation and just get a little bit deeper with people is something that I really, really value and enjoy. The fact that people listen, it's had 55,000 downloads, blows my mind.
Mm.
And the fact, you know, and the comments and the compliments and the feedback and the, it's overwhelming how impactful it's been. And I try not to think about that too much because it's like, whoa, okay. But as long as people are listening and as long as it's encouraging them, then I'll keep doing it. And I think initially it was just like, I feel like this is what I want to do. So I'm going to go and do this. And if it gets traction and it becomes popular and it helps people make a change for the better, then that is wonderful. And that's exactly what it's doing.
Most definitely. What's the biggest lesson potentially that you've learnt through speaking to people that you've found most beneficial?
About sobriety or about podcasting?
No, definitely about sobriety and definitely okay. About that journey and stuff.
I guess it just affirmed to me that everyone's sobriety is their own story because I've not had an identical conversation on the podcast. And I have chatted to well over 70 people now. So everyone's journey is their own and they get to it in their own unique way and they wrestle with it in their own unique way and they, get through it in their own unique way. And so I love that because it means it's available for everyone. It means that it doesn't matter who you are. You might find similarities between your story. Like I do have a lot of people say, oh my God, like when I was hearing you tell your story on the podcast, so I did my own last drink story on my 8-year anniversary of my last drink. And I had loads of people reach out and go, oh my God, like your story is exactly the same as mine. I'm like, wow, that's great. Because then you can see me in you and that means this is doable for you. And that's awesome. But also within that framework, everyone's story is completely unique to them. And so I love that because so it means that there's endless fodder for a podcast on sobriety because there's endless amounts of stories. And one story one day is going to connect with one person who may not have chosen sobriety, and that kind of excites me.
And I think the biggest thing for someone to pick up out of any of the podcasts or anything they listen to about sobriety is the whole story might not be exactly the same as theirs, but look for similarities rather than.
Yeah, I think there's definitely elements, which is why I share my story so much. Because again, I have people be like, "Oh, that I feel exactly how you were at when you decided to stop drinking," which is good.
Mm. And like even little stories, like I've heard people share. You know, some people are like, "Oh, I'm not an alcoholic," and ended up on a park bench, whatever that may be. And I've heard someone say once, my park bench was my lounge chair.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. Everybody's different. Now you've written a book of the same title, Last Drinks. The book covers everything from yours, as you mentioned, to other people's personal stories, science on how alcohol affects us both physically and mentally, a sober toolkit, along with a 30-day alcohol-free journey that the reader can go on. How did you decide on the structure of the book and the way it was written?
The principles of great storytelling is just have a beginning and a middle and an end. It's how I go into every single radio break that I do on air. You have a beginning, you have a middle, and usually a zinger at the end. And so I just applied the same logic to storytelling in the book. The beginning is alcohol, why alcohol is the problem, what alcohol does, how it affects us. I talked to a neuroscientist about how it affects our brain chemistry. I talked to a GP about how it affects our body functions and a sleep expert about how it impacts our sleep. The middle bit is sobriety and what that can do for you, what that looks like on other people, curating a sober toolkit to safeguard your sobriety, having a bit of a game plan. And then the final bit, the end, is the you can do it too practical handbook where you can just I can hold your hand through your first 30 days sober as your sober buddy. So a beginning and a middle, and it was a bit of a no-brainer, the structure, and I kind of came up with the idea pretty quickly because I just knew what I wanted the book to be, but I didn't just want to share my thoughts, my story and my wisdom and then go, cool, now good luck. You know, I really wanted to equip people, and that's why that third part was so important.
How much you seem to have done a lot of research for the book too, because there's a lot, as you say, there's doctors' opinions or doctors' things in there.
Mm-hmm.
Other people's stories, like Osha's story.
Mm-hmm.
How much research did you have to do for the book? I assume a bit.
Yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot of interviews, a lot of reading. Like it's all science backed, so I had to read a lot of medical journals. but I'm a super nerd, so. I loved it. I loved the whole process. I feel like I learned a lot. And then, you know, being able to articulate all of this super science nerd stuff into really easy to read language was a challenge. But I think it's worked out well. I don't know. You tell
it
me.
It has. It's worked out very well.
I think it's a good book.
I think it's perfect. It's perfect for anyone to read. Anyone, as you say, anyone that's got any sober curiosity. Even if you're curious, it's a great book to read because it goes into detail about everything from just thoughts to medical to, hey, here's an outline of some things to try.
Yeah.
You know? It's perfect. Thanks. I mean, I even read... You studied psychology?
Oh, I was studying psychology, but then I had a very turbulent 2022. So everything, that's just all on hold at the moment.
Yeah,
I just don't have the capacity to do that right now. But Long term, I would love to get my Bachelor of Psych Science purely because I love studying human behavior and why smart people make dumb choices, which might be the title of my next book. but it's just all on hold at the moment. I've got too much going on, so I'm just keeping a few things off the plate for now.
Yeah. So your early months of sobriety, if you look at things in your sobriety toolkit within your book, as we mentioned, like journaling, bedtime routines, breath work, what did you find most helpful in your early months of sobriety as far as some of those toolkits that you mentioned?
So the journaling one's probably the biggest one. So the first January 2015, I journaled every day. So I wrote in a journal. Sometimes I wrote about what I was thankful for. Sometimes I wrote about what I was upset about. Sometimes I didn't know what to write about, so I wrote about not knowing what to write about. But I did like a daily journal every day. And then a few months after that, I went back and read that journal, and it was very insightful what I sort of discovered about myself and the lack of self-compassion I had, the lack of self-worth I had. And so then I was really able to kind of go on a bit of a journey and implement some things in my life that would sort of, you know, prop me up in the self-esteem department. So I did that. And so everything in the toolkit's pretty much stuff that I did at some point to like either fill in time or something like that I lent on to explore something new or fill in the time, really, if I'm going to be completely honest. It was because I spent so much time drinking. When I stopped drinking, I had loads and loads of time on my hands, and it was very overwhelming at first. So I was like, well, I just need to do stuff, so I'll just do stuff. And that's really, I think the first 30 days is just surviving that. And then from there, I think you can start to do a little bit of self work and, you know, digging and, you know, counseling or whatever you want, because there will be probably some past trauma that comes up because everyone drinks for a reason.
Yeah, well, I think you mentioned that somewhere. I don't know if I read that in the book or somewhere else, about you went back and you looked at why you ended up on that journey to MTV and so forth.
Yeah, it was a very good season of self-reflection, I think, and just understanding why I'd made certain choices and chosen certain directions and chosen alcohol, really. And then, you know, you got to forgive yourself from all the past stuff and not try to beat yourself up too much about it, which is what I did.
Perfect. And as you say, you guide people. There's the 30-day journey, so you don't really have to think about it for the first 30 days in the book.
Yeah, because I think,
because you guide that.
Well, yeah, it's just, without that sounding overwhelming for people, it is, you just read. It's a little bit of a reading and one activity. That's it. But it just is a guide, because those first 30 days can be a lot and they can be really triggering. So, you know, day 1 to 6, you might be like, I'm killing this sobriety thing. And then your boyfriend might dump you. And then you're like, oh my God, how do I deal with a bad thing, you know, 6 days into sobriety? So it is really just a bit of a framework on how to do those first 30 days and just set yourself up for a win, rather than go into it blindly and fail because you haven't set yourself up. So the whole first 2/3 of the book is setting you up for those 30 days. It's not just like random anecdotes from my life. Like everything in there is purposefully put in there to safeguard you as you sort of enter into sobriety and see how it feels. And it will feel weird for a lot of people at first. I remember the first few days I was like, I felt just lightheaded. I felt really loopy, and I was like, oh, this is actually clarity. This is how I'm supposed to function. And it's now after day 4, when all of the toxins have been taken out of my system by my liver, thank you liver, that I now actually have a clear head. But it feels really woozy to me because I'm not used to it, because I'm used to running on a deadened sense of everything, because that's what alcohol does.
And what did you do in that first 30 days with regard to alcohol in your environment? What about environment? What did you do?
Yeah, so in the book I kind of go through this, but you can get the book, but I kind of guide everyone through what you should do. So what you should do at home, what you need to do if you're going out. There's all sorts of things. There's alternatives. There's how to occupy your hands. There's how to respond to people. There's if you drink at home alone, how you can combat that. So it's all in there. But I feel like I address everything really thoroughly for people, again, with the sense to like really equip them for success in that time in sobriety.
Most definitely. Now, I know this is a big time period, but when you think back to 15-year-old you dreaming about being a host on MTV and that the journey to 34, I believe, when you got sober,
mm-hmm.
how do you feel when you reflect on that chapter of your life?
Oh, I love it. I love that I had a dependence on alcohol because without that, there's no sobriety story. And without, I'm not saying I love it, like I'm recommending it. I'm not recommending it, but if you're listening to this and you're engaged in this, you probably have a drinking problem of some level. So I don't regret, like I said, I don't regret anything. And I love my story. I love that I set goals and I, you know, kicked them out of the park. And I've, you know, worked in a career that I love and I'm really good at, and I've stayed at the top of my game even through sobriety. And I think that I really don't regret a thing. You know, some of the choices I made when I was drunk, yeah, probably not my wisest, best moments, but I was inebriated with a toxic substance that changes your brain chemistry. So like, what was I supposed to do? So I love my journey. I love my sobriety journey the most because it's given me the most joy and it's connecting with people. I thought that I was like a, you know, serial connector when I was networking and pissed. But I have connected with so many people in sobriety, and that's what I definitely love the most.
Yeah. And I think that's for me personally, two things is, I don't feel I'd be who I am today without that drinking period.
It's hard, right?
It made me who I am today, and I'm happy to be who I am today. It's a really funny story.
It's a really weird one because, again, you don't recommend it, right? Like, I don't just recommend that people just go and get a drinking problem. Yeah. But if you've got one, there is hope for that person because if you don't see the light unless you're in the darkness. So for me, even though I had this, like, outrageously successful career and all of these undertones of anxiety and, like, compounded pressure and just life stuff because life is hard – I'm glad I got to where I got when I did because I don't like to think about what would have happened if I didn't. And I guess that to me is the kind of serious part of the conversation that I really want to urge people that your sober self is always going to be your best self or a better version of yourself. And you don't have to wait till you are rock bottom to make that change. You don't have to wait until your life resembles The Hangover or Leaving Las Vegas or any other movie. You can make a change today, even if you think that maybe you just want to stop drinking wine on the weekends because you only drink wine on the weekends, but it's every single weekend. You can actually change that behavior. Now you have all of the tools and the equipment. It's all in you. It's up to you when you decide to make that decision. And I'm glad I got to mine on the 1st of January, 2015.
And I think you touched on something that is quite important too. Connection, like you think when you're drinking that you've got these connections.
Oh, it's so
and
weird.
Then when you become sober and you actually have a connection, you're like, I didn't really have connections. They were just like fleeting moments every now and then.
And I think people, one thing that I was terrified of is like losing my friends. And I think that a lot of people are like, I can't quit drinking because I'm going to lose all my friends. Like, well, you'll find other friends. There's like 7 billion people on the planet. Like, you'll be fine. There are heaps of other people. And I think that can be really, you know, that can keep people imprisoned in drinking behavior because they are scared. But the right friends who love you for the right reasons will support you. And one thing that I said to, you know, my nearest and dearest was like, I'm not asking for your opinion right now. I just need your support. So like, don't come at me with just have one on the weekend. I just am asking for your support. And that's a really good way to work around any confrontations you might have with mates if you decide to go sober.
Curious, Glenn?
Yeah, my husband.
Did you meet after you got sober?
No, we met in June the 7th, 2014 was when we met. I told him I had a drinking problem. in October of that year, and then I quit drinking in the January.
Yeah, cool.
Hmm. And he didn't leave me.
That's right. Well, as you say, those that are closest.
He didn't leave me. My mother didn't divorce me, so we're okay.
That's right. Exactly. That's exactly a very good point. How do you feel you have changed as a person since your last drink?
I don't think I've changed. I think I've just learnt more about myself and I've just evolved. So I'm still me. I'm still good old me. I'm still, you know, coming up with content every day on the radio show, finding myself in really funny situations in life that I reflect well through my storytelling on air. And so I think I'm still me. I'm a more evolved, grounded and wholesome version of me. I'm more patient, definitely. I sleep better. And I think the biggest one for me was when we were talking about younger Maz, and I was saying that I was really, you know, outgoing and confident. What I've realized as an adult is I'm an introvert, which is so funny. So when I say introvert, I don't mean like shy, quiet, timid. I mean like I recharge from alone time. And so I have this really big personality and I have a performance gene. That's from my dad, definitely. Mm-hmm. And so you have this big personality and this big performer and I'm great at storytelling and captivating audiences and that's what I do. But I need everyone to just get out of my space when I need to reset. And if I don't have downtime to reset, I am not good. So my husband's the opposite in the sense that he resets by socializing with and engaging with people. He's an extrovert. So we get to the end of the week and he wants to connect with me and have a chat and I want to go to the other room by myself. And this is something that we've had to work out because if I don't get downtime, I don't recharge my batteries and then I'm just running at a deficit the following week and the following week and the following week until I will snap and then cause like a huge problem in our relationship or what have you. And then we find ourselves in dire straits. So I've had to learn that asking for time out and like walks on the beach by myself or a little bit of alone time is actually necessary for my survival. Now this might explain why those MTV years were so problematic for me, not realizing that I was an introvert at the time. And what was I doing every single day? I was around people constantly. All day, every day, hair and makeup, producers, assistant producers, runners, drivers, rock stars, pop stars, managers, everything, constantly, right? Then I lived in a share house with some friends, so I had no alone time. Then I was out till all hours being social because it was my job or I was just scared to go home and be alone. And then I would eventually be alone, but I would just pass out and then I would wake up and then I would go to the gym with a friend and then come. And then I never had any downtime in those 5 years or even actually the time when I sort of pivoted over to radio. Like I was just never alone. And so I never got the one thing that I need to recharge and reset. And so I was on an adrenal and caffeine and alcohol cocktail constantly. And it is no wonder I ended up in hospital twice in my career from dehydration. From purely burning out. Like I was so burnt out because I was like, but I'm an extrovert. Like I'm a people person. I'm a social butterfly. But it was absolutely the opposite. And so I found that's been the biggest discovery. I only realized that in sobriety. So you can imagine my shock when I stopped drinking and all of a sudden I was like, I really just want to be at home by myself. What's wrong with me? And then I actually gave myself permission to be at home and recharge by myself. And I was like, oh my God, I feel so good. And so that's that big learning is now so key because I know how to ask for the time and the space that I need to show up to be that extroverted performer that everyone loves listening to.
Yeah, I think there's a big thing that I've heard before too. Like when people get sobriety, they want to spend more time with themselves.
Yeah, I think you just learn about yourself. And so it's not that I've changed, right? Like my behavior has changed because I'm not doing stupid things because I'm not drunk, sure, but I'm still the same person. Like I'm just a more whole person with bigger self-compassion than I ever had. But all of the you know, like all of the intricacies and the fabric of my DNA is still all in there. Like that, that can't change. That's inherently who I am. But learning about yourself can help you manage yourself better and treat yourself better. And then I think the knock-on compounded benefits of that are a better place to live out of than chasing your tail, you know?
And I think when you're drinking, you think you're going to lose who that you that you think you like when you're drinking, when you get sober, you actually just become you.
Yeah, like I think you do. That's one way to explain it. I do. I think you do. I would agree with that. It's just, it's funny because I think some people would say that they do change and that's their story. But I don't like to think of it as this like metamorphosis that I was this like caterpillar that went into a cocoon and came out a butterfly. I'm still me.
You're already a butterfly.
Doubt it. But yeah, I'm still me. I'm so much more at peace with who she is.
Yeah. In your first year of being sober, you lost your job on Sydney Radio. And in the last, you've mentioned earlier in this conversation, the last 22 months has been pretty tough. In that last 22 months, you've experienced very deep grief through your own dad's passing and a very close friend, from what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind if I ask how you've dealt with these moments in sobriety? Because I think it's these sort of moments that people are afraid of.
Yeah. I think, look, because I'm so far down the sobriety track now, like when my dad died, I didn't think, oh, my God, I need a whiskey. Even though it was a really complicated relationship, the circumstances in which he passed away were extremely tragic. What I've learned, so I went to a therapist. I've been in therapy all year. For ages, because grief is a really big one and we don't get taught how to do grief. We don't get taught how to process grief, that it's a journey. So I've just been going to therapy to try and figure out what that looks like and reconciling my dad's death and my friend's death, very different situations, but they were 6 months apart. I think, in sobriety, you have the capacity to deal with the really tough stuff well. And that's what I've done. So I think, you know, drinking Maz would come up to a crisis in life and spiral and drink more to push it away, forget about it, ignore it, pretend it didn't happen, or like numb the pain. But in sobriety, I've just sat in the pain and it sucks. But you know, I often say like sobriety doesn't stop bad stuff happening. You know, sometimes I think people are like, oh, I've got to get sober so that my 4-year-old's going to be more tolerable. I'm like, your 4-year-old is going to do your head in because they're 4. But sobriety gives you the capacity to handle it better, you know? And I think the same with grief, like sobriety has given me the capacity to actually process the grief, come to terms with some really big loss and try and figure out how to navigate life without these two really important people around.
And I think you touched on it too, communication and talking it out.
Mm.
You know, like we think when we're drinking, you'll blurt out whatever it is when you're drinking. Oh, yeah, blah, blah, blah. But when you're sober and you actually have a connected conversation and you actually get to get it out, I think that has a massive impact.
Yeah, and I think spilling your guts when you're half cut at the pub, you're probably not talking to a trained professional who can actually give you some like real world guidance on how to navigate tough stuff. You know, like the people that you're drinking with are not going to be the people that are probably going to give you the best wisdom. So I highly recommend that, you know, you get a counselor, call Beyond Blue. They have amazing counseling services. Help is out there. You can pay for it. It's free. It's government subsidized. I went and got a mental health plan from my GP. I did 6 sessions on the mental health plan. I went back for review and he said, you can have another 8 sessions because you were clearly dealing with some deep trauma. So, you know, so that's helpful. So I'm still very much in the trenches of all of that, but at least I'm working through it with a clear head.
Yeah, that's so good to hear. Now, there aren't many, but there was one post on your Instagram as I scrolled back through Maz's.
God.
I'm like, let me research Maz. Scroll back through Maz's Instagram.
Go way back to the archives of my Instagram.
I'm like, does she have any like drinking pictures on there? There's a couple. I think there is. There's one that I was like, oh, I remember those days. It was a Canadian club.
Oh, yes. And I was wearing a sombrero.
Sombrero, yeah.
But do you know on that, Luke, it's funny. You should have gone through my Facebook because my I was super – I used to treat Facebook like it was Twitter.
Facebook's older,
mate,
yeah.
It's all on – all the gold that you were hunting for is all on Facebook. Some of my Facebook status updates from like 2011 were like – woohoo, off to Sydney, smashing cans on the plane. Like it was all about drinking and partying and just that was my whole like online life update was just me smashing cans with the girls. It's funny to look back on.
I don't know how I didn't end up on Facebook. I didn't though.
What a shame.
I know. I missed all the gold. But what I did end up on though, yeah. On Instagram, which I found quite interesting because it's very much the way we celebrate. And yeah. That is, you must have just done, it was November 17, so we're only a couple of months out from, no, November 17, 2013, so we're a year and a bit. Mm-hmm. Actually, I got the dates wrong.
Yep.
A City to Sea run number.
Yep.
You know, and then this
in Melbourne.
A schooner of beer. So it wasn't a schooner of beer then, it was a pint or something. Yeah, a pint of beer.
Yeah.
If you're in Victoria. With the comment, I did it. Yep. I was like, you know, I'm rewarded now. And I 100%. Read that as I'm rewarded now with this beer after I've just gone and done this amazing athletic activity and now I'm rewarded with this beer.
And not only that, my friend Yvette and I had planned this for months. We were living in Sydney at the time. We flew down to Melbourne. We went out to a fabulous restaurant. We got absolutely wasted and then we woke up and did the City to Sea and then we went to Republic down at St Kilda past the finish line and just drank beer with everyone all day. Isn't that ridiculous?
And so looking back on that picture, what do you think of like that? That's just like that part of society, I suppose, and that part of like
look, I think
celebratory.
It makes me go, okay, that's where we're at. Like we celebrate with beer and we commiserate with beer. We, you know, go out and drink. We stay in and drink. If something's good, we drink. If something's bad, we drink. If it's a celebration, we drink. If it's a commiseration, right? So our whole culture is obsessed with alcohol. We drink alcohol all the time for any excuse, good, bad, or indifferent. And that is a real, I think, timestamp on the drinking culture in this country. But what I will say is that I think it's changing and I think it is swinging the other way for a few reasons. I think that the younger generations have looked at the boomers, Gen X and Gen Y and gone, what a pack of dickheads. Look at them carrying on, drinking themselves silly, behaving ridiculously, making terrible choices. Let's not do that. So I think the younger generations have seen the impact that alcohol has had on people, I think probably 35 plus, and gone, I don't want to do that. And so the research has come back saying that the younger generations drink less than ever before, which is really positive. Mm. So I think it's the pendulum is swinging back the other way. And so those kids aren't going to need to get sober because I don't think they're going to end up with alcohol dependence. I think there's more education about alcohol and its effects in society and it's, you know, responsible for 11 different types of cancer. It increases your cancer risk. So many deaths worldwide attributed to alcohol. So I think that the information's getting out there and people are like, huh, this isn't that great anymore. Let's make a different choice. And I think that coinciding with the non-alcoholic drinks boom is really positive too, because if you want to go out and be social but not drink alcohol, you can have a non-alcoholic spritz. And it's kind of acceptable and perfectly okay. So I think there's a few sort of things that are lining up where the culture, even though that like beer at the end of a fun run is still quite ingrained, I think it is swinging, which is great. And my hope is that these conversations, my book, the podcast, all of the things are going to, I guess, ignite a bit of a revolution where when my son is a teenager and is at a party, that being sober will be normal and it's the person that's drinking alcohol that is the person that gets asked, oh my God, what happened? Are you okay? Obviously something is out of whack because you're drinking alcohol. And that is the opposite of my experience where as a sober person, I've been the person in the bar that's asked, what's wrong? What happened? Why aren't you drinking? I fully believe that that is going to do a complete 180 hopefully within a couple of generations, so that sobriety is the norm. And I think it's starting now. It's starting to shift.
And you go into that in the book, like that whole and like I said, when I've seen you out, we spoke about that a little bit, and that is that whole uncomfortable, like when someone says, so why aren't you drinking? And you go into that in the book about like having just sort of that one line, because otherwise you feel that pressure of you need to explain yourself and you need to go into great detail about why I'm not drinking and this is going on and whatever that may be.
That's right.
So you can definitely get helped out in the book with regard to that as well. So finally, if you could speak to 15-year-old you that's about to have that first drink, wanting to fit in, with aspirations of being an MTV host, what would you tell her?
Probably just drink bourbon and Coke instead of straight bourbon. I don't know, because it...
I mean, it could be positive, because at the end of the day, as we've both said, like the drinking journey was a positive. Like, and I wouldn't be who I am today without that drinking journey. So it's not necessarily a...
It's a hard
don't
one.
Don't do it, wrap across the...
You know, because like in one sense, I'm like, oh, you go get your dreams, girl. I'm like, well, I did. You know, it's like dream as big as you can imagine. And it's like, well, I did. And so I don't, you know, I don't know what advice I have that's very practical, because I, for some reason, I feel like I did have this kind of weird sense all along that I was going to do great things. That sounds a bit random, but I just have always, I don't know. I've just always, it's always been spoken over my life, and I feel like I've always had this sort of inner knowing that I was going to do something cool. And to help people has always been a bit of an undertone, and maybe that comes from, you know, dad's ministry days or whatever. So I don't know. That's such a terrible way to end this conversation, but I don't know what I would say to her, because.
Anything along the lines of just be kinder to yourself?
Yeah, maybe, but then, maybe be kinder. That's good. I'll do that. I'll say that.
No, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I need a bit longer to think about it, but it's just a really hard one to, first of all, it's a hard one to not make a joke about. And this has been terribly like unfunny chat, which I'm not used to, but it's hard because I don't, like, I love her so much. I love her innocence. I love her chutzpah. I love everything she did and everything she stands for, and I don't want to tarnish what she was and what she represents in my life. And I knew that things, I had this sense that, like, I know the road isn't easy. You know what I mean? Like, I just had all these, this inbuilt framework of stuff that maybe other people would look back and go, yes, this. But for me, I'm like, it was all kind of there. And I love what she represented. And I think 15-year-old Maz was a bit of a legend, and I don't want her to change a thing, really, truly. Because then we don't get to 43-year-old Maz, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I'm happy to just let it all just be as it is. And now knowing what I know, being sober, journeying through what I'm journeying through, I'm excited about what's to come, you know? So is that a suffice response?
It is, because I think that's a very important note, is that in sobriety you become so happy and so thankful for all the moments, even the drinking moments in the past, regardless of what they were, regardless of what happened, and you know, because they were blessings to get you to where you are today.
Well, and I think it's subjective, so I think it's too. Perfect. Like, I think there's some people that look at their 15-year-old selves and they're like, you know, you can do this in counseling where you're like, I forgive you, Mom. You know what I mean? Because there's some trauma there or whatever. But for me, there's not. Like, I just think she was so ahead. She was a real trailblazer, 15-year-old Maz.
Oh, that's good. It's quite the opposite to me, I can tell you.
Oh, I bet. But again, everyone's story is different, right? We both landed at sobriety, so.
Yeah, that's right. So, well, I'd like to finish on one line that is mentioned in your book, Last Drinks, for anyone that listens to this and does choose to go on a journey of sobriety. And that line is, if you slip up, please be kind to yourself. I think that's most important. Don't beat yourself up for anything on the journey.
Yeah, totally. I haven't slipped up, so to speak, but I know heaps of people who have. And I think what sometimes can happen is you it's like the gym. You start at the gym, you go to the gym for 3 weeks, and then you miss the gym for a week, and then you just don't go for 17 years. I think with drinking, sometimes you can have a stint in sobriety and then have a drink. And then instead of having 40,000 cocktails the next day, you can actually just reset, like hit the reset button and just actually forgive yourself and go, okay, well, I screwed up. Okay, well, what is the trigger? Like, what is the thing that set me off? Like, what is the thing that activated that part of my brain that set me down that path again? It's got nothing to do with willpower. It's just got to do with how your brain is wired right now. And it takes a really long time to rewire your brain. So I think if you can just be kind to yourself, and one of my biggest things in the book is like, just be kind to yourself on this journey. Don't do the whole deep remorse thing. I'm sure you've had to hand out a few sorry cakes in your time. We all have, you know, and that's why I included so many stories from my podcast, because those people's stories are really important as well. And I think rather than being, you know, oh, woe is me, so I'm a terrible alcoholic, so I have to spend the rest of my life in sobriety as a punishment. Like, it's not that. Sobriety is such an exciting life choice that you get to make every day. And if you slip up, it's okay, but don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like, you know, restart, go back to day one or however you want to do it. Some people might want to keep going either way, but keep going.
Absolutely. Thank you, Maz, for sharing this space with me today.
That's okay. Thanks.
And for all that you were doing to try to help others on this journey. If anyone would like to find out more about Maz, her podcast or her latest book, Last Drinks, please go to mazcompton.com.
That's it. You can order the book's in all good bookstores. And also online, and the podcast you can get on any podcast platform. So if you just search Last Drinks, you'll find it somewhere.
You will. I've listened to it and it's excellent.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks, Maz.
No worries. Yay!
Coffee with a Coastie is brought to you by On the Coast Publications, the publishing house for On the Coast families and On the Coast over 55 community magazines on the central coast of New South Wales.